Today, among other things, we'll encounter dribbles on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble. 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Connie Hecker's books range from A Cat Named Dribbles to Corporate Histories. We'll traverse that range and the Writer's Almanac with Garrison Keillor on Scribble. Okay, that was shameless. I could not avoid using dribbles because of rhymes with scribble.
That's okay. I think that's fine. No problem with that.
But that is quite a range. I mean, from a book about a cat named Dribbles to stories about Permar and Call and so on. That's
I would just suggest that the reason that I do so many variety is because Augustana turned me into a liberal arts major, so I'm
sorry.
A wide variety of interests and a wide variety of publications, but it's all Augustana's fault,
Well,
that's a possible approach, but that's how I explain myself anyway, because everybody else thinks I'm crazy.
Well, minority opinions cannot be ignored. But that's also been my thing. When people say, how is it you've done so many things? I say, well, in part because I can't hold a job. And secondly, because my attention wanders. You get interested in things and you go looking for them.
I know. Do you remember when I interviewed you a long, long time ago for a feature for the Dispatch? Still remember what you said.
Oh, dear.
I do. I never, ever forgotten what you said that day.
What did I say?
You said that I was talking about writing books and, just pursuing some of those interests. And you said that you would never write a book because you could never write anything as good as Shakespeare. You remember that? No, probably not.
Shakespeare is very taunting.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Most of us don't compare ourselves to Shakespeare, though.
Well, I don't compare myself. I shy away from all comparisons.
Sure.
That's the same reason I gave up singing. I heard Leonard Warren sing the song I was trying to learn, and that was it. Why do it when someone else does it so much better?
Well, I know, but we miss out on a lot of joy in life if we don't pursue some of the things that we love, whether we're very good at them or not,
Well, you blame Augustana, I blame Roald Tweet. I am guilty of a book, and it was Roald's doing.
I blame the C-plus I got in freshman English.
Really?
Yeah. I was an aeronautical engineer till then, and I got that C-plus, which I thought was worth an A. Uh-huh. It was really worth a D. I look back on it. But I said, I'll show that guy, and I overdid it. So,
but as fascinating as your writing about Dribbles is, and that's a children's book, I hope.
Yes.
Okay, but Corporate Histories, how did you get into that?
Sometimes it's just opportunity, and when someone has heard about me and some of the projects that I've done, they come to me. A number of these were just word of mouth, where someone was talking to somebody and they said, we're interested in doing a history. Do you know of anyone? And they would mention me and probably Marla Svensson, who's no longer in the Quad Cities, and Roald Tweet, and he's usually busy teaching college classes. And that was then, so mm-hmm. Some of those were earlier projects.
What was the first one
The first one was actually the Lindsay Park Yacht Club. The first 100 years. And I loved it because it was the river. And I loved it because the photos were so beautiful. I have favorite photos, but they're all the people sitting on the houses with the old, the hats and the long dresses and the boats on the river. Summer's just very romantic. Just wonderful.
Yeah. So, I've been over there for lunch a few times, but romance was never part of it.
Really? Here, this one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're looking at pictures now. And,
yes, we are.
I'll hold the next one up close to the microphone so you can see it. But when you, the Lindsay Boat Club is one thing, but Permar is another. And then how do you get into this? I mean, how much research do you have to do, and are the company files open to you?
There's a lot of research, and really to get into them, I collect any information that I can get in the literature, and then I go to interviews, and I interview all of the people that they want interviewed. And some companies put a few people on to start and then add people later, or sometimes I have an extensive list, and they're not always here. Some are retired and elsewhere, like the Lewis Rich history that I just completed the manuscript, and it's with the Riches now. It was 83,000 words, more than 350 photographs with captions.
Wow.
We got into the project, and then it was decided that they'd like to have profiles of the most important people. Their list of people, you know, people that were important to them. I mean, there were other people probably who were important to the company, but we couldn't do everybody. But a lot of those were not local. A lot of those people are retired. They're living somewhere else. So those become telephone interviews. Email is very helpful for interviews. So lots of different ways. But talking to the people is such an important part of the project because it makes it more current, and you get lots of different perspectives on the history, and they get a chance to bring in their experiences with their department or whatever, you know, whatever focus they had with the company.
So, I hadn't thought about that before, but I bet they do sort of change their minds and enlarge their scope when they find out what you're doing. So you probably end up doing a quite different thing than even they or you imagined at the beginning.
There was one history that I went in and I said, this time I'm going to give, you know, a bid for the project on what everything I can find. So I tried to get all of the research. I tried to get everything, you know, all of the list of people they wanted interviewed. I really tried to be thorough in trying to pre-research it. And after we were in the project about 4 months, they cleaned out the attic and found boxes of memorabilia that they wanted me to look at. So no matter what you do, it seems to get bigger as you get into it.
You know, that's interesting. I've been trying to clean out files and stuff in my house. And I found some old files, and going through there, I thought, my goodness, I forgot about this incident. Mm-hmm. I forgot about this person. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize I had this picture. Mm-hmm. And you think, how do I throw this away?
Yeah.
That's tough.
You don't. And there are museums and libraries that actually save that. The Curlin Library or museum in Minneapolis, St. Paul, takes whole collections of previous manuscripts from well-known authors. You know, I mean, they have, and the women's, there's a women's history collection in Iowa City at the university where they take manuscripts or previous materials.
Oh, yeah. But I don't have manuscripts. I just have garbage.
Well, you know, sometimes we think it's garbage, but it's not. It really is history. And a lot of times, you know, that photo might not be as important anymore to you, but it's important to someone. And someone else doing research might come across it and think, oh, what a find.
Yeah. So how do you bid on a job when you don't even know what you're going to run into?
Well, you try to find out what you're going to run into. The most recent history I did, the family had enormous archives. I mean, you couldn't supplement with anything from any of the other libraries. I mean, I didn't have to do that kind of running around or anything because they had saved copies of everything. So you just try to find out how much you think is there and go from there. And then you start with basically a base proposal, you know, for what you think it's going to cost, and then you know, work on that.
But that could change then.
It could change, but then you also, you add parameters. So in the beginning, there aren't any profiles or anything, but you leave a space for that so that you can include those later if you need to. So it's not like I'm not going to do it. It's more like, if we do this, you know, I'd be happy to do it, but this is how much you know, we're going to have to add to the cost of the original contract.
Well, where do the children's books come in?
In between, here and there.
What motivates you to do that?
Oh, I love them. I just love, I'm the regional advisor for this Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators in Iowa, which is probably a whole another story, but I've been doing it for 16 years, and we do programming, and I love the artwork in picture books, and working with middle grade and YA, I mean, the stories are wonderful. I just love the literature.
I've got to hear a line from Dribbles.
Okay.
Where's Dribbles?
It's right here. It's right here. You want just a line, or you want a scene?
Well, give me a scene.
Okay. Okay. Why did she have to die? Benny asked quietly. Gracie looked at Bing in his red collar and Benny in his yellow one. Her eyes, too, were sad. I think life is like that. All living things are born and live until they die, said Gracie. She knew we loved her. I feel better because we were friends and had time to say goodbye. Yes, but why did Dribbles have to die? You know, said Bing. And he did.
Oh, we got the Dribbles death scene.
That's yeah. Well, that's, it's, you know, it's the whole book. Yeah.
I want to make sure before the time runs out that I, it seems to me one of the difficult things about corporate histories is quite often there are skeletons in the closet.
I know. Isn't that fun?
Well, but not for the company, is
well,
it?
Well, what you have to remember is that this is their book. You know, you are serving the project, and they have total approval of everything that goes into the book. So it doesn't go to press until it's totally been approved.
Right.
And usually I do that.
But have you ever been asked to not do something?
I've been told something is off limits. Yeah, okay. I've heard stories that I know can't go in, but okay. I don't want to air anyone's dirty linen anyway.
Okay.
You know, to me, it's the history, and those are inside stories. And yes, we had one corporate advisor who was looking at this project and said it wasn't going to go to press because he was scared to death that we were going to tell too many stories that were not good for publication. So, and I, you know that. You know that you go in and you're going to hear stories, and you might hear something on a side or relationships or whatever, and you just know that's not what you're looking for. You're looking for the history of the company and how it got to be successful and where you think it might go from there.
Yeah, and yet the most interesting story is always where the bodies are buried and who put them there.
I know.
But... And that's why official histories are of some value.
Sure.
But they're not to be taken as true histories.
I know. Yeah. I know. But, you know, that's a mystery writer or that's a historical writer who's very independent and is published by a corporation. Mm-hmm. Or, I mean, a publishing house, rather than the corporation itself. Because the corporation itself will always want to approve the copy that's going in, you know, mm-hmm. to their financed project.
Do you have a steady stream of these things you work on?
I would say they're hit and miss, depending on lots of different reasons. The most successful projects are usually ones that the corporations or the people want to do themselves, because I have tried marketing, you know, to pull in more corporate histories, and it hasn't worked as well as if someone comes to me and says, you know, we want to do a history, and how much will it cost, or what do we need to do, or how do we start, you know.
Where did the impetus for the Call legacy come from?
That came from Rose Campbell and the Call Foundation, so mm-hmm. that the Scott Community College Foundation wanted to do a book on that project. And it was shortly after they bought the building and they were refurbishing it for classrooms and working with that. Henry Call was very interesting, and Roll Tweet's Rock Island Lines. I think you should play that again as a rerun. I was so fascinated with his interpretation of that story, and I thought, gosh, that's, you know, it was really interesting. He found details that, and a perspective that I hadn't even thought to look at.
Gee, someone was listening to Rock Island Wines.
I love it. I try to catch it every time I can. Yes.
Why do corporations generally want their histories done? At what point?
Often it's a legacy. Often it's an anniversary, like 100 years or 150 years. Alcoa did one at 75 years. The Davenport Works did one at 75 years. So it's usually some sort of a milestone. Often it's a legacy where the founders or the some of the older people in the company might be looking back and thinking, you know, we should save this while we can and preserve this while we can. So
do you do everything, the layout, the photos, the size of the book?
No, I would say not. I would say it depends. Now, I did with the Outing Club, I did all that. And with the Lindsay Park Yacht Club, I did all the layout and I did the photos and the captions. I would say most go to, you know, I do all the text, and then I do all the captions on a different document, and then the photos are all arranged and you try to keep them all together so that someone else, and then they go to the printer, and the printer goes through them and they lay out, you know, so that it's another process beyond what I do. I make suggestions. Like I'll say, oh, maybe in a post-it note or something, this is really important. Run it big or bigger or whatever.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, that the layout is that's a special art. That's a special art of laying out. I knew a fellow, Stan Graves, who used to lay out our magazine, Communique, and his work was brilliant. I was just astounded at how good he made everything look. So when you have that ability, that is a special talent. And it doesn't always go. You can write or you can lay out, but it's seldom that you get the two together.
Yeah. The Alcoa Davenport Works, I worked on that, and I was called the research editor and writer. So I did a lot of the literature and I did a lot of the interviews. But they had some other people go over it. But they turned the design and production over to Silver Oaks Communications, which is here in the Quad Cities. Mm-hmm. And then it went to the printer. So different processes.
Connie, you're a busy person.
Some days, yes. Some days, no. It varies. It really does. It's like all of us. We all have schedules that vary.
It would take my full day to write. You gave me a copy of your resume. I couldn't finish that in a year, let alone any one of the works in it.
Well, from cats to corporate histories, Connie Heckert covers it all. Thank you very much, Connie, for spending time with us. It's very interesting to hear about this. We had not delved into the business of corporate histories. We know they're there, but we didn't know who did them.
It's been a joy. It has. They're all so interesting, very different, but they're joyful. They really are.
Well, you keep celebrating your joy.
And, I can do that.
And right now we will celebrate a fellow who has retired from his basic radio show but still does the Writer's Almanac, Garrison Keillor. Support for Writer's Almanac on WVIK comes from the Mississippi Valley Regional Blood Center, working together with volunteer donors to provide blood products and services to hospitals throughout the region. Information at bloodcenter.org. Into the book bag we go, and I find someone there clutching a book.
Well, you're not clutching a book, but you're clutching a review. Pete Peterson, the guy that runs APRIS, put me on to a review of a book that I haven't read, but I want to read, and it fits right in with our discussion with Connie and her interest in corporate history. This book is called How the Post Office Created America.
Oh, very good.
By Winifred Gallagher.
Yeah.
And I had not thought about that. I do remember growing up going down to the post office because we had to get our mail at the post office. There was no delivery in my little town of 1700. But the post office is where you got together, you met people, you gossiped, you read all the poster, the wanted things were in there. I can recall going in there spring mornings when the baby chickens were being delivered in the back and the constant beep, 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 feet of, of boxes and boxes and boxes of baby chickens that the farmers would then come in and pick up and take home. But it really was a kind of meeting place. But what is interesting about this book is that it suggests, the opening line is, the history of the post office is nothing less than the story of America. And what it suggests, I had never even thought about, is that the Post Office Act of 1792 helped turn abstract ideas of democracy into a concrete reality by authorizing mail service for the entire population rather than the privileged. Everybody suddenly had access to the documents, to the news, and all throughout America. And that meant, you know, I mean, there were post office services before in other countries, but they were for the privileged few and they were for official documents. This meant that every piece of mail could be sent to every single citizen in America. That also meant, of course, that you had to build roads and bridges to get to the farms. And so roads and bridges were improved because the law dictated that everybody had to have access to the post office. And then in 1847, the postage stamp was invented, and that meant that the person who sent the letter had to pay for it and not the person who received it, and that increased. But the real invention of America came at the end of the 19th century when they invented rural free delivery. And that overnight meant that new places like Montgomery Ward's and Sears could compete with the merchants in your little town and, in fact, drive them out of business because it could offer goods, it could offer clothes, it could offer refrigerators, it could offer shoes. I mean, it could offer everything, houses even.
That's
in
right.
In the case of Sears. That could be delivered free out to your farm. And that suddenly transformed. I suppose it marked the beginning of the demise of the small town, because the merchants in individual towns, you were at their mercy, right? You had to buy what goods they had, and yeah. No longer could you. You could get your Montgomery Ward's catalog, as we did, and order.
Or you had to wait for the Wells Fargo wagon to come in.
Or you had to wait for the Wells Fargo wagon. But anyway, and then the parcel post came in 1912, and that's what really allowed farm families to free access to stuff from the mail order catalogs. I hadn't thought about the way in which one little thing like that, I mean, this is a big corporation, but it, how America would be different if it wasn't. And then 2 days later, this is just an ad, it has nothing to do with a book, I saw a PB, a public television story on Appalachia, and the claim made there that what created Appalachia was the radio. Because suddenly the National Barn Dance and the Grand Ole Opry and music and it could come to every little town, every little hollow, and it sort of created a South.
Yeah.
It created a Southern music. It created a Southern folklore.
What's the name of the book?
How the Post Office Created America. Hmm. Somewhat of an exaggeration, but not much.
Not too much of one, really. And to think there are people still trying to put the post office out of business.
Well, it's...
That's criminal. But that's another story, and not for today. Roll tweet, and I'll be back next week for the next edition of Scribble. Plan to join us then.